This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The first presidential debate between Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump was the most watched television event of its kind in history. But so much has happened in the 2 weeks that elapsed between that first debate and last night that anticipation for the second town hall meeting was far higher than originally anticipated. Last week, WikiLeaks released what they said were transcripts of speeches that Clinton had given to Wall Street high rollers and big banks. Next, Republican higher-ups began abandoning the good ship Trump due to the release of a recording of a lewd conversation between Trump and then-Access Hollywood host Billy Bush back in 2005. For a while, it looked as though leading Republicans would pressure Trump into resigning his candidacy, but Trump had said he has no intention of quitting the race and in his so-called apology statement alluded to things Bill Clinton had said in private conversations between the two men that Trump alleged were far worse. So the debate went on as scheduled last night, and this hour we Monday morning quarterback that moment in American history and the possible impact of these sidebar events on this election cycle. Three of our go-to political scientists are here, Dr. Eric Heberling from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, and Dr. Adolphus Bilk from Winthrop University. Welcome back to all three of you.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
I honestly don't know where to begin this morning. I have no clue. So let's start with Friday. The most recent revelations about these candidates, I guess, came last week. I mentioned the WikiLeaks, which we'll get to, but the Access Hollywood tape that was put out Friday, in any other year with any other candidate, would this have ended the candidacy of the candidate?
Well, I think it would, except for the fact we've known about Trump and his disrespect, put it mildly, of women, any other person, Muslims, African Americans, Hispanics. And Michael Cruz, who from Politico said, celebrity and power. These are the things that have fueled Donald Trump all the while. And perhaps we shouldn't have been so surprised. But I think people were saying, why are we so surprised? We shouldn't be surprised. But here we are having the elites all jumping ship now. A list so long, I couldn't even count. Over probably 30, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's a big list. But I look at it this way. This very sort of thing disqualified Gary Hart. You know, a number of presidential cycles ago. And then when I think about Howard Dean was regarded as being less than presidential because he had a yell that wasn't regarded as being rather manly.
So what happened between those that time and this time? What has happened in America?
I think part of what's happened is a shakeup within the GOP. You had a lot of Republicans who felt that they had given their support to candidates who promised to do things for them on social and political issues and that they did not deliver. And in particular, I'm thinking about the rather conservative evangelical base within the Republican Party. And so they had so much antipathy for the career politicians in the party that they said, well, let's support someone who's not a career politician who might actually follow through on the things that he promises.
But the things that he has been accused of saying, and that we've heard on tape him saying, are antithetical, one would think, to the religious beliefs and moral codes of people who would describe themselves as evangelical Christians. And yet, he seems to be getting a pass. Why?
You would think so, but when we look at the data that came out of Politico reported that 39% of all of their respondents thought that Trump should step down and resign his campaign. But that number was only 12% for Republican respondents and 13% for Republican women. Nothing has stuck with this guy. And he's made a number of disparaging remarks about different constituencies over the course of a number of months. But now that we're talking about something that was said that principally involves white women, it's become a much greater discussion, but it hasn't immobilized him.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have this baked into their attitudes about him. His supporters have already decided that they like him for other reasons. I don't think they're totally dismissing these risks about him, but other things are important to them. His leadership, his confrontational leadership style, his ability to stick his finger up at Washington, and they're willing to dismiss the other things that they would hold other candidates to much higher standards for.
Well, I'm sorry.
Well, I'll just say this: it's changed since Howard Dean and Gary Hart. And Gary Hart is very interesting point because Gary Hart said, come on and find it.
Right.
Trump said, come on and find it. But two very real and very simple things since that time, reality television and cell phones. And so everything is everywhere. And we make celebrities out of, I mean, dynasty people recommend candidates.
Well, you know, I was going to ask this question much later. I'll ask it now. In other countries, leaders and people running for office have had sexual liaisons with people other than their spouse. And it seems to roll off the back of the electorate in those countries. In this country, we are absolutely obsessed with sex. It's everywhere. It's all around us. It's in advertising. It's on sitcoms at 8 o'clock during the family hour. We are obsessed with it. And yet when somebody actually has sex or talks about sex and they're running for office, we get all in a dither. Are we being two-faced? Is it time for us to get over it? Does this really matter?
I think that's a reflection of American political culture. So yes, pornography is a multi-billion dollar industry and Americans are obsessed with sex, but at the same time, you know, you have 240 plus years of this Protestant morality that has influenced American politics and policymaking, that Americans believe in being sexually chaste and displaying some sort of restraint. And that's influenced social welfare policy and a lot of other policies.
But last week we had a vice presidential debate in which the last question was about the candidate's faith. And it was like going to Bible study on both sides of the aisle. And this last night, the first question was about Donald Trump's sex tape.
You describe kissing women without consent, grabbing their genitals. That is sexual assault. You brag that you have sexually assaulted women. Do you understand that?
No, I didn't say that at all. I don't think you understood what was said. This was locker room talk. I'm not proud of it. I apologize to my family. I apologize to the American people. Certainly, I'm not proud of it. But this is locker room talk.
Just for the record, though, are you saying that what you said on that bus 11 years ago, that you did not actually kiss women without consent or grope women without consent?
I have great respect for women. Nobody has more respect for women than I do.
So for the record, you're saying you never did that?
I said things that, frankly, you hear these things they said. And I was embarrassed by it. But I have tremendous respect for women.
Have you ever done those things?
And women have respect for me. And I will tell you, no, I have not.
So between what happened between last week with the vice president and last night, we have two. It's like whiplash.
Well, and it's almost as if Trump did not realize that Pence can insulate him from a lot of the criticism. And I just have to point out three things.
He was clearly angry at Pence
last
night.
But to say I am a gentleman, mm-hmm. I respect women. Mm-hmm. Women respect me. These really strike men and women as ludicrous. Women are in locker rooms too, and I assure you there's no such talk about men. I like the men respond. I don't see men as ever talking that way in locker rooms. Perhaps I'm naive.
Adolphus, you were saying before the show, I think to Eric, that athletes are striking back at that comment.
Yeah, two quick points from you on this. First, I think about people like C.J. McCollum, who's an NBA player for the Portland Trail Blazers, studied journalism in college at Lehigh University. He and a bunch of others have talked about this and said that these are the sort of things that we don't tolerate. You know, that, yes, people talk about certain things and their exploits, but this is someone who's openly discussing what can be described as sexual assault in placing his hands on someone and advancing in a way that is not welcomed nor reciprocated. So that's the first point. The second point, I think that this led to one of the big moments of the night early in the debate with Secretary Clinton, where she said, I've never questioned a Republican's fitness to lead, but I question his capability and comportment to lead this nation.
Well, I've never seen a presidential debate ever where the one candidate will say, out loud, and she said it last night, I think she said it the previous debate, that the other candidate is unfit for the office of president. And she did come back to try to combat some of the things that Donald Trump denied, but and talked, I guess, directly to the women in her audience.
We have seen him insult women. We've seen him rate women on their appearance, ranking them from 1 to 10. We've seen him embarrass women on TV and on Twitter. We saw him after the first debate spend nearly a week denigrating a former Miss Universe in the harshest, most personal terms. So, yes, this is who Donald Trump is. But it's not only women, and it's not only this video that raises questions about his fitness to be our president, because he has also targeted immigrants, African Americans, Latinos, people with disabilities, POWs, Muslims, and so many others.
So last night's debate, in addition to the questions from the moderators, there were questions that were coming from unaffiliated or undecided voters. Did that comment resonate, do you think, with undecided voters, or is she just spitting into the wind?
I think trying to broaden it was wise to make the point that this is just not an isolated incident. She tried to make this an overall evaluation of his character and fitness for office. The question is, for those undecided voters, is they, to the extent they've been following the campaign, this has been the tenor of the campaign throughout. Is this anything new that's going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back or cause them to reassess?
There doesn't seem to be a straw that breaks the camel's back, except with high-ranking Republicans who are trying to figure out how it affects them, not how it affects the country, how it affects them, the down-ballot races, et cetera, and even the Speaker of the House to a certain degree. So I have a question about that. If Donald Trump does not win this election, what must the Republican Party do to repair this kind of damage? This is not... I'll leave it at that.
Well, this is something that many of us have been thinking about and talking about for quite some time. And the way that I see it, if Donald Trump loses this election, he is still a very affluent and powerful man who will have opportunities in real estate, in television, in other industries. But if you're the Republican Party, you've now had multiple and consecutive presidential contests where you've taken a thrashing. And you really have to rebuild the party. And if you think about the way that winning coalitions are assembled, you need votes. And you can't continue to alienate large and growing segments of the electorate and think that's going to produce a winning strategy. They seem to try to go back to a playbook where you can rely on your most dependable demographic, which is largely white men. And that segment of the electorate is shrinking.
But this isn't the party. This is Donald Trump. So the question is, has the party gotten away from the party?
Right now, it's his party.
Yeah.
He's the standard bearer. He's at the front of the ticket. He's the face of the party, whether they wanted him to be or not. And so this will be their mess to have to deal with once he's done, if he's done.
So here's
there were many traditional establishment Republican candidates available in the primaries. The Republican base preferred Trump.
Right.
And the Republican establishment still is, as you mentioned, running away from Trump. The problem is the establishment, the people who have mapped out the plan of how you modernize the Republican Party, their plans are not supported by a significant chunk of their own
base.
There's
a big conference call this morning, evidently on the table, on the schedule for major Republican leaders. What will they talk about? What decisions do they face, and what was the likely outcome of that conference call based on the performance of Mr. Trump last night? He seemed to kind of win that debate last night.
Oh, I don't think he won the debate, but I'll say this. There is no walking back.
He dominated.
Yes. And he dominated in a way that I don't think is very seemly. I think his stagecraft was threatening. And as you say, he's gone from insulting women to, I think, assaulting women. I think the Republicans can't walk back the elite unendorsements.
When we come back, I want to find out what you guys think, our political scientists think, about if he wins. What does this say about American politics and about us? We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and O2 EMC, an independent power producer that develops, owns, and operates solar farms, working with institutional investors and banks to bring clean energy generation to rural communities. O2EMC.com. And Central Piedmont Community College's Collegiate Test Prep, offering weekend ACT exam preparation classes starting October 29th at CPCC Central Campus. Details at collegiatetestprep.com. Charlotte.com. It's been a tough year for Charlotte. First, HB2 put us in an unwelcome spotlight and resulted in millions of dollars of losses, and then protests and riots following a police shooting ripped at the heart of this new South City, tarnishing our sparkling reputation and our image of ourselves. What kind of damage has this done to us? And more importantly, how do we repair the internal damage to this city for those who live, work, and do business here? We look at that on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, analysis of the second debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in St. Louis and how the candidates perform in the town hall setting and what that means for the final weeks of the campaign.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with our roundtable of political scientists, Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, and Dr. Adolphus Belk from Winthrop University about last night's second of three, we assume, presidential debates, the town hall-style meeting, which was preceded by a week of scandals on both sides and an event that happened just about an hour before the debate took place, which we will also talk about. But I want to ask the question, if Donald Trump wins, given what we witnessed last night, what we've heard over the week, because last night, I don't care whether you're in his camp or not, was simply unseemly. There is no other way to put it. If you are the father or mother of a fifth or sixth or seventh grader, in normal circumstances, and I heard, I'm not stealing this from somebody else. I thought this last night, but I heard somebody else say this on television. In normal circumstances, you would want your child to watch this exercise in American civics. Last night, if you were a responsible parent of a fifth, sixth, or seventh, or even eighth or ninth grader, you would have sent them to their room and turned on Nickelodeon for them.
Sure. I mean, even if they didn't give all the sordid details of the tape, you can say, Mommy, what does grope mean? And a lot of other things. I think this is really a sad day.
It was a descent into personal attack. There was very little to talk
sure.
about policy or politics or disagreement over legitimate things. It was mostly she's a liar with hate in her heart and he's a predator.
Well, in the very first moment, I'll say this, when he was asked about the quote-unquote locker room talk, he pivoted to talk about ISIS. Not more than 10 or 15 seconds into the question, and I knew this was not going to go well for him or for the American public because it did not address the central feature of what we wanted in the debate.
Adolphus. That was something that Mr. Trump did frequently last night, but let's say this. There have been a lot of studies in our discipline which have demonstrated that elected officials, once they get into office, try to do the things that they promised on a campaign trail. And with Mr. Trump, he's talked about a wall at the Mexican-American border. He's talked about flagging Muslims and Arabs on their entry into the country to make sure that they're not terrorists. He's talked about taking stop and frisk nationwide, a policy that's had some rather deleterious consequences for young black men and Latinos in places like New York City. And he's talked about jailing his opponent if elected.
That could be the one thing that comes sure. out of this that is the single most alarming thing, because the last time I checked, this was not a banana republic. But as of last night, perhaps we have become one.
I didn't think I'd say this, but I'm going to say it. And I hate to say it, but if I win, I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation, because there has never been so many lies, so much deception. There has never been anything like it. And we're going to have a special prosecutor. When I speak, I go out and speak. The people of this country are furious. In my opinion, the people that have been long-term workers at the FBI are furious. There has never been anything like this where emails and you get a subpoena. You get a subpoena, and after getting the subpoena, you delete 33,000 emails. And then you acid wash them, or bleach them, as you would say, a very expensive process. So we're going to get a special prosecutor, and we're going to look into it, because you know what? People have been, their lives have been destroyed for doing one fifth of what you've done, and it's a disgrace. And honestly, you ought to be ashamed of
Secretary
yourself.
Secretary Clinton, I want to follow up on that. Yeah, I'm going to let you talk about it now.
Because everything he just said is absolutely false, but I'm not surprised.
Really?
You know, it is, it's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Yeah, because you'd be in jail.
Secretary Clinton.
Now, listen to that reaction from the crowd. There were two moments of reaction, one in favor of him, one in favor of her. I don't even know what question to ask after that, but is anything he said true?
Well,
given the number of investigations that have taken place with the Clintons and Secretary Clinton specifically since the early 1990s, if she were guilty of a criminal act, she would have likely been in jail by now.
So is he just saying that because he knew he'd get that reaction or because he's trying to deflect the attention from himself and his own problems to her?
Well, I think I go back to what my colleague was saying. You know, if he's explaining and taking all this time to explain, then that's getting him off message. And so his pivots were sharp. It was locker room talk. It happened a long time ago. I was, you know, he didn't say I was young and foolish because he was 59, but that's kind of the vibe of it all. And then it's right back to going on the offensive. He lives to be on the offensive.
And well, he would put the bully in the bully pulpit.
Yeah, and
his supporters are predisposed to think Hillary Clinton is guilty. So it doesn't matter what of. All he has to do is charge her, and that's what revs up his base. That's where the cheers are from.
And if you said which statement was true, there may be some, but I'll tell you which statement struck me as true, and that is when he said, she is a fighter. Now, that's true.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I just there's so many things to talk about. I don't know where to go next. How will this affect, do you think, the down ballot races, particularly for those people who have either distanced themselves and unendorsed him in the Republican Party, or those who are still on the fence about distancing themselves and unendorsing him?
I think, to use Trump's word, it will hurt them bigly.
Which way?
I don't think they'll be successful. I think what they want is they can distance themselves all they want, but what they have to have people to turn out. They have to have the Republicans that are not Trump turn out. They have to have the undecideds turn out, or, you know, at least.
But if you're Deborah Ross or you're Mr. Cooper running, I can't think of his first name right
Roy.
Now. Roy, thank you. Running against the governor. Does this hurt or help you? Are you just rubbing your fingers together and doing the happy dance, or are you scared to death?
I think it hurts Republicans in different ways in different places. Suburban women have been a weak spot for Trump throughout. It makes it much less likely that they're going to turn out to vote. That hurts Republican candidates statewide and, say, congressional candidates or state legislative candidates in those suburban districts. The type of Republicans you've seen disendorse Trump on Saturday are really just a couple types, a few in competitive districts, a few women Republicans, and Mormons. Earlier in the campaign, there were polls that had Clinton within reasonable margin of victory in Utah, which is typically the most Republican state in the union. Conceivably, the events of the past weekend could put Utah back in play because it's the Utah representatives and Mitt Romney who have been very vociferous in denouncing Trump's behavior.
So prior to the – I'm sorry, Adolphus.
The Republican supermajority in the legislature did a lot of things in North Carolina to try to restrict the voter pool to a population that could produce results that would benefit them. Mm-hmm. And those things were struck down at the courts. And so what that means is that some of those measures that had a rather harmful impact on minority voters, younger voters, older voters that go Democrat, well, they're going to come back in line. And people respond rather strongly when they feel as if they are under attack. And so I think that those African-American voters, especially African-American women voters, and some of these other demographics might come out in a strong way so that Hillary Clinton in a place like North Carolina might have some coattails that help these candidates.
In Florida, I believe, early voter registration was to have closed over the weekend.
Yes.
Or at least into this week. And because of Hurricane Matthew, a lot of people had to evacuate and are probably just getting their lives resituated as we speak this morning. And the last I heard, the governor of Florida had no plan to extend the deadline for early registration. That will help Republicans, will it not?
It'll help Republicans in a place like that. And part of what we've seen is that when we look at the Republican attack on voting rights, the argument has been that there's this great degree of in-person voter fraud. And it's more likely that I'll be struck by lightning than someone will show up and say, I'm Adolphus Bulk Jr. and I'd like to vote. It's really been about trying to shrink the electorate to something that can produce victories for them. And people are pushing back against that, right? And so I think that when you look at some of these states, yes, Republican governors are trying to do the sort of things that will help their party in November, but folks have also been going and trying to undo those things in the courts.
I want to circle back to the question I asked just going into the break, and that is, if he wins, if Donald Trump wins, what does this say about American politics, the American voter, and what pluses or minuses does that bring to the GOP?
Well, it shows there's a lot of anger, and that we're reacting with anger and not necessarily looking for specific constructive solutions. What Trump has been selling are symbols. Keep out the bad guys, and pretty much that's it. But in terms of governing, as we've seen this weekend, there are substantial fractions of the Republican Party who don't like Trump either, and he's going to have to govern with them in Washington. Speaker Ryan's hope is that Ryan's agenda will be just taken up by Trump. I think that's his best hope, but I don't know how realistic it is. I think you have a split Republican Party that's going to be hard to get things done. And given Trump's authoritarian tendencies, he's not going to sit around and say, oh, well, checks and balances is preventing me from doing
things. One of the things he's kept coming back to last night was how ineffective she has been in 30 years of public service. I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure it's not. But the fact that you're a United States senator, he kept saying, you were a senator, why didn't you fix it? This, I think, telegraphs something that he doesn't understand,
right,
about how the system works. She's one of 100 senators, and there are 535 total congresspeople on Capitol Hill. One person is very unlikely to do a lot of stuff over the course of 8 years as a senator, or 6 years, whatever it was, or even 30 years in public life. It's damn hard to get things done. It was designed that way.
It sure is, and I think that belied the fact that he doesn't understand checks and balances, separation of powers. The only person that could really move but not accomplish those things would be the President of the United States. One thing before, when we've talked about what we can expect in the future, and that is greater unpredictability. I look at the people Trump has decided to surround himself with, not really responding to other party elites, and I say to myself, what sort of persons would he surround himself with once he was in office? And that is a very scary proposition, even maybe beyond certain policies. It's who would he take advice from?
Well, and particularly the fact that during the campaign he's made evident that he doesn't listen to advice.
Sure.
So it's really not terribly important who those people are, because you mentioned the uncertainty. He's uncertain in terms of what he would do.
Secretary Clinton shot back at Mr. Trump by saying that she had her name on 400 pieces of legislation that she either sponsored or co-sponsored during her tenure in the Senate to try to solve some of the problems that she had addressed or that she attempted to address over the course of her legislative career. Now, as far as what a Republican Trump presidency would mean, I think it would mean the revenge of white nationalism. His emergence is rooted in the economic tension that came out of the Great Recession and this perception among white Americans that they were losing ground in particular to increase political and economic competition from people of color. He was at the forefront of the birther movement, though he did try to pin that on some of Secretary Clinton's people in its origins. And he has certainly campaigned as the candidate of white rage. And he said, you're angry and I will be the candidate of your anger. And we have to remember the tenor of his meetings across the states and the rallies and the violence that took place at those rallies when people were protesting peacefully in response to his presence. And so a victory by Trump is a victory for that rather repugnant element of the American political culture.
This is part and parcel of the anger, I guess, but we now live in a society in which facts are irrelevant. It's feelings that are, and perceptions that are important. And when you go back to Susan Roberts, to the what kind of people would he have around him as president, etc., this is a person who Politico says they can't keep keep up, PolitiFact rather, can't keep up with the lies he tells. And the fact-checking has come out in the New York Times today. Almost everything he talked about last night was either partially inaccurate or completely inaccurate. And yes, he will not dispossess himself of spouting what he considers to be truth. Is that because he really truly believes it's true, or is it simply because it works for him politically, and by God, I'm going to keep saying it?
It's worked, and it's worked for a long time. This is the Lee Atwater playbook. You know, Lee Atwater said a long time ago that people aren't necessarily going to vote based on what they think, but how they feel, and you want them to feel a certain way about you, and so he's projecting what he wants people to feel about him.
And Lee Atwater told me in the dressing room at South Carolina Educational Television in 1983 that in politics, the ends always justify the means.
Well, I think, too, it's you look at Frank Luntz and what he's been talking about. He says it's not what you say, it's what they hear. And so people can hear what they want to hear, and some of it is emotional. I think Trump he didn't say law and order last night, but I agree that he is talking about Hillary Clinton does not have hate in her heart. Everyone has something in their heart that might be unseemly, whether it's discrimination against people who smoke or drive too fast. I think it was a very sad day when you can play on the emotion, but also we need to say to ourselves, how far do fact checkers, do they make us feel better because we look at it? There's a new book out that says, do facts matter? And I think that for much of the electorate, I hate to be so blunt, but facts don't matter as much as feelings.
Facts matter for the other candidates. Yeah. They don't matter for mine.
So let's talk about that, because his was not the only scandal, so to speak, that came out. Let's talk about the WikiLeaks revelations that came out over the weekend, revealing that Hillary Clinton told bankers that they were best placed to help reform the U.S. financial sector, and that she also favored open trade and open borders. And going back to her Abraham Lincoln allusion, that she says, I have to say one thing to you to get your money and one thing to voters to get their votes.
Well, I want to just say one thing about that. She was watching Lincoln, and she looked at how he approached Congress. They had to anticipate that question. Mm-hmm. So either it was true.
I thought that was a horrible answer.
Either it was true, but it was also very lame. They had to anticipate the question.
Right.
It had to be true, because who would let her say something like that? Right. Who in her campaign would let her say that? And it made no sense to me.
That was my reaction too, that it had to be true, because it was a ridiculous answer. And there was such a simple response, I thought, that Here you have Donald Trump on the other side, written the art of the deal. Donald Trump wouldn't go into a bargaining situation and give away his true answer, his last position. Of course, when you're bargaining with the Russians or with Congress, you're going to have one public position and a private position. I mean, and it's easy to explain.
An old line in presidential studies is that the essence of presidential power is the power to persuade, and that you have to convince others that what you want is really what they should want, but for their reasons and not your own. In dealing with the question, she tipped her hand. But there are a lot of elements of the WikiLeaks scandal, and as they relate to the leadership of the Democratic National Committee mm-hmm. and Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, that have been especially damning. And those related to how they were attempting to dismantle the Sanders movement. And to Mr. Trump's credit, he kept coming back to that. You're not honest. This is how you try to take things. And so while he acknowledged her dogged determination, he also made it clear that he thought it was in the pursuit of things that were not fair or right.
Dr. Adolphus Belt from Winthrop University, here with Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College and Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hollins University, dedicated to producing graduates with confidence, leadership skills, and drive, whatever the career, research lab, classroom, or stock exchange. Hollins works to improve the path. Hollins.edu. And the Charlotte Symphony, performing Beethoven Symphony No. 2, along with Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 1, October 14th and 15th at Belk Theater. Details at charlottesymphony.org. Well, the analysis of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's second presidential debate in St. Louis continues in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Get another perspective on how the candidates performed in this town hall style meeting and what it means for the final weeks of the campaign. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it right now. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter, like Donald Trump would. At Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
When colleges can't teach agricultural education to students, agricultural technology companies teach those students themselves.
We're actually creating a huge apprentice grower force just because we don't trust that the market's going to give us good growers.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the future of farming. Next time on Marketplace, we'll have the rest of the day's business news, of course, and the numbers from Wall Street as well.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the presidential debate. Loads of people who are listening want to talk to comment on this as we talk with Dr. Adolphus Belk from Winthrop University, Dr. Eric Heberling from UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College. Let me share with you some of the comments that have been coming in. Jeff in Davidson. What I have noticed in last night's debate, as well as our national debate in general, is how low the standard has become. Last week on C-SPAN, I listened to a rerun of the Geraldine Ferraro and George Bush VP debate back in the 80s. The discussion was much more sophisticated, informative, and nuanced. Can our experts comment how our debate has risen and fallen throughout U.S. history? My concern is that we are dropping to a new low that is dangerous to our democracy. There have certainly been periods where the debate has been rancorous, mean, and unsophisticated, but is this a new low?
I mean, the lows and the things you saw on the clips, the 10 worst moments of debates, were, you know, there you go again, or I know Jack Kennedy, you're no Jack Kennedy. Those seem tame, to be an understatement.
Well, is this a low for
today,
the modern era, or this? If you went back to 1859, would it be just as bad?
Well, we've had some of those conversations before, and I like to go back to the campaign in 1800 between Adams and, you know, John Adams, the incumbent, and Thomas Jefferson, the challenger. You know, Adams said about Jefferson, you know, he's the half-breed son of an Indian squaw and a mulatto. So people have said some rather nasty things about one another on the campaign trail, but you would think that, you know, with advancement in time and a different set of values
and advancement in education,
out, right?
This country's never been more educated,
I mean,
than
Mr.
it is
Trump
right now.
Calls Secretary Clinton
everybody
the devil.
Hears this now. I mean, it's out there. These kind of things have gone on, but now they go into the mass populace. Now you can get it on Twitter. Now you can watch it on the 24/7 news cycle. We all are consumers, and that's a big change.
As people who look at this and analyze this and talk about this every day with students for a living, does it concern you that we are devolving into something that soon won't be a democracy and we will not be governable?
Well, I'm glad we're on fall break.
Yeah, I mean, I think what people see is they think that's how we should behave if that's how they see other people doing it. And in terms of, you know, the lack of policy, you talk to political consultants, you know, they tell their candidates, don't talk about policy because that's not what moves people. You know, talk about personality, talk about your biography and attack the others, you know. Voters complain, oh, I don't like negative advertising, but that's what they react to, so that's what they're going to get from candidates. And I think this campaign is the epitome of that it's all personal attacks. And even when the candidates have an opportunity to talk about policy, they don't. I mean, Hillary Clinton had several opportunities to talk in detail about policy last night and just said, well, go to my webpage.
Well, I think Jeff and Davidson is on to something in this sense. This matters. The way we talk about politics matters because you're socializing an entering generation, right? So if I think about the people who make up the largest segments of the voting population right now, millennials and Gen Xers, they listen to the evils of big government and government waste, government inefficiency for the better part of their formative years. And as adults, they believe those things. And so if you look at the way that people are talking about politics now, I teach American government every semester. And while my students are not necessarily representative of millennials across the nation, they look at some of this stuff and they tune out. One of the hardest parts of my job in a course like that is getting people to sort of put down what they think politics is because of the way politics has been presented to them. That's the first thing I have to break through as an instructor.
Well, and I think you also put this in the context of polarization, which is tried and jaded, but is also true. And then you add on to that what Adolphus said, is the fact that they're also getting their information for better or for worse from SNL, from they were from Jon Stewart, late night television, and that breeds some cynicism.
How much of this devolution of the American political culture has to do with the elimination on television, in broadcasting, of the Fairness Doctrine?
The argument,
does anybody know what the Fairness Doctrine
argument,
is?
Yeah. The argument from
you should answer that.
The argument from the Reagan administration during the 1980s was that the Fairness Doctrine was no longer needed because you had so many television stations, so many radio stations, that you didn't have to hold a single station responsible for presenting alternative viewpoints when you could find them anywhere. Now, what it means in the current environment that we live in is that you don't have to take seriously the arguments of the opposition, or you construct them in such a way as to make them easily defeatable. So if we go to, you know, a station over here founded by, you know, Rupert Murdoch, we know what we're going to get. And we also know that the opposing side is going to be presented in ways that are not necessarily an honest reflection of the opinions and perspectives that people really hold. I think that something like the Fairness Doctrine could help, but we've become so entrenched in some respects, I don't know how much it would help.
Well, I think also, go ahead, Eric.
That there are such a variety of outlets today, the marketing plan of many of these outlets is to target particular niche audiences, and people can select only the information that they want to hear. So we reach out for information that confirms our pre-existing biases and avoid information that's going to challenge.
That's not new. Didn't we always do that?
No, but that's the point.
It's easier to seek it out.
It's easier now. Back when the Fairness Doctrine existed, it was basically the three broadcast networks that had to be even-handed or present both sides on major issues.
And so many chose not to do it at all because that was the argument. Because if I have to give up airtime for both sides, they just won't do it at all.
Well, and then the inundation of super PAC ads and candidate ads and negative ads on television, they really benefit financially the networks. And that's where a lot of people get their news, are these ads that are inflammatory, but in many respects, they speak to a certain demographic that wants to read. They want to say yes. They filter through their partisanship, and they say, yes, that's what he is or she is.
Back to listener comments, a Twitter comment. I don't think Trump won over undecided women. He aggressively stalked and harassed Clinton the whole time. People have made a lot of his looming over her in the background. He did pace a lot. He never sat down once it started. She did during his, so she was never in his shots, but he was always in her shots. And a lot of commentators were saying last night it looked ominous and it didn't speak well to women who would have felt uncomfortable with this very big man lurking in the background behind him. Do you think that was intentional or simply he had so much energy and he was so angry about all these things going into this that he simply couldn't stop moving?
Well, I think that it's probably both. I don't think he doesn't know the camera's on him all the time, but I think he intimidates women in many ways verbally. I looked at the camera angle. I was very uncomfortable when I saw him looming over her shoulder. And I think the walking around, the smirking, it was poor stagecraft. I don't know what was in what he did, what his intentions were, but it didn't matter because that's how it came off. You should always think the camera's on you.
And it was surprising because I'm sure he was warned ahead of time that about these space issues on stage with female candidates. I mean, this is lesson number one.
They may have run out of time, as one of the commentators said, because on Friday when they were doing debate prep, this tape, the Billy Bush tape, the Access Hollywood tape, emerged. Now, just prior to the debate last night, about an hour before the debate last night, Donald Trump called the traveling press into a conference room, allegedly said that they could observe debate prep. A little late for debate prep, an hour before the debate. When they got there, there were these, three or four women who alleged sexual involvement or sexual assault on the part of Bill Clinton toward them. What role do you see that playing last night in this debate, before, during, and after?
Well, I think one thing, just immediate reaction was, whatever they were supposed to do, they didn't do it because all women said they supported Donald Trump. I support Trump. He wants to make America great again. And only one woman said about Bill Clinton's actions towards her. So if he wanted a lot of heat and light, it didn't generate much, except it came off looking like a stunt.
Well, he did this an hour before the debate.
Sure.
It was obviously to throw her off kilter. You know that her campaign people were in a tizzy about this, trying to figure out how to react to this on stage. And then he sat the women in the audience.
Yeah.
Obviously all designed to throw her off. Did it work?
Well, I can't say if it worked or not. I didn't see her looking over there or the camera angle. I think it was not just to perhaps throw her off, but also to reiterate and try to say, this is who he is. Let me tell you, I'm sitting here with my family and these women, and it's very prominent
politically,
in my
mind.
It worked in the sense that it gave the press something else to talk about.
Sure.
He tried to change the nature of the conversation about his groping remarks, and to some extent he did that. Now, did it work to get her off of her performance during the debate? No. They were asked about 20 questions either from the moderators or people in the audience or people online, and her answers spoke directly to the questions that she was asked, and her rebuttals focused on those things that he tried to do to shift the conversation away from the question that was being considered. So she was composed, she maintained her messages, and she stayed on task in a way that he did not. He was simultaneously trying to deflect things that he thought would damage him and focus on those things that he believed would hurt her.
But I think that's why he was more successful last night than he was at the first debate, that he was able to shift the focus from defending the indefensible things that were brought up in the first debate to weaknesses of her. And he clearly got his theme across that she's been in Washington and hasn't done anything, which fits his whole anti-politician appeal.
MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell said last night it was obvious that Donald Trump is no longer running for president. He's running for the position of not being as bad as Bill Clinton in terms of sexual bad behavior. What, politically speaking, what has Bill Clinton's sexual peccadilloes got to do with anything in this race?
It just allows Trump to marginalize, to put off to the side, gives his voters an excuse to say, well, we're not defending his behavior because someone else has done something similar, therefore it's okay.
He also brought up the saint of the Democratic Party, John Kennedy, and his behavior, and he brought up LBJ and his behavior, which are all well known now, but they weren't then.
Well, I think also we look at, again, the fact that, as Eric mentioned, that Bill Clinton is not on the ballot, but I think, you know, when Trump said, I'm not going to bring these things up because Chelsea is in the audience. That didn't ring true to me. Chelsea is a grown woman. And,
she's hurt worse.
Yes, and he's tipped his hand. I mean, they probably should have known that something, because he had tipped his hand saying, I'm going to talk to Jennifer Flowers. I'm going to bring out Jennifer Flowers.
Yeah.
And so there was a point at which you thought you saw it coming.
Republican political consultant Mike Murphy said last night after the debate that the debate was small and sad, but it didn't matter because Trump was dead before the debate and he is dead after it. This is a Republican. Do you agree?
People still get the vote. And when you look at some of those battleground states and you look at the demographics of the electorate in places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, while his chances might be diminished, he still has a chance. And part of the reason why he still has a chance is that he talks about things in ways that resonate with the people who fit the profile that might support him. Last night, whenever he made a mention, if there were a question from the field from an African-American, if he mentioned African-Americans, it was an immediate and hard pivot to poverty, crime, joblessness, and violence. And I'm sorry, those things do not define life for the overwhelming majority of African-Americans in this country. 85% of black folk have high school degrees. 20% of them have at least a four-year college degree. 2.6 million black-owned businesses in the United States. 2.2 million African-Americans serving in the military. 17.8 million voted in the last presidential election, and black Americans had a higher voter participation rate, 66.2%, than any other demographic, and they were led by black women. This this man has had plenty of time to study up and try to find a way to siphon off a bit of support from black voters, from Latino voters, maybe to get back to where George W. Bush was in 2004, and he hasn't done it. Part of the reason he hasn't done it is because he's going by the old playbook, let's get as many of these disaffected white voters as possible, but there are enough of them in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida to matter.
So Leanne on Twitter writes, did the GOP die this weekend? They are totally out of touch with voters from polls of continued support. Lisa in Salisbury writes, this isn't locker room talk. There are many women who have been groped, assaulted, or who had no option but to quit a job because of behavior and speech that Donald Trump has repeatedly done and made. And add this to the overt racism. I don't understand the cowardice of this Republican Party. They allowed this and have stood by him by and large. Bill writes, no one is talking about the real question. How did we end up with these terrible candidates? The primary system does not produce noble, healthy, effective leaders. The primaries have produced partisan candidates that are out of the mainstream. The primary system needs to be overhauled. Is that true on the Democratic side? Is she out of the mainstream? People will say that she's a Democrat, she's a terrible candidate, and even Democrats, some of them, are going to the polls voting for her by holding their nose.
Well, she had the three ingredients that everyone says you can win the invisible primary. She had money, she had name recognition, and she had organization. And that's what we've, as political scientists, but this is where the nomination is going. This is who wins the primary. It was not a particularly deep bench at that time, and she was the presumptive heir. But you look at it, that didn't help Jeb Bush. So all the money didn't help Jeb Bush. And that really changes some of the dynamics of money, organization, and name recognition.
I think the challenge going forward is that the Republicans have consistently lost presidential elections, but they've done very well in midterm elections and state elections. Likewise, they have a very deep bench of senators, governors in presidential elections going forward, and the Democrats don't. They've been wiped out, essentially, in Congress and the state. So even though it looks like the Democrats have the coalition of the future, anytime they don't show up or until we get to that future, their ability to implement any type of policy is at real risk.
So will there be a third debate on October the 19th? Because there's some question about whether one of the other candidates will not show up for it.
If there is, everyone will watch.
That's right.
How do you think the ratings were last night? We don't know how the ratings were last night.
I bet they were pretty high. I don't know who was playing football, but I think everybody was watching.
All right. That's Dr. Susan Roberts, a professor of political scientist at Davidson College, Dr. Adolphus Bell from Winthrop University, and Dr. Eric Heberling from UNC Charlotte. Thank you all.